Coming up on Boston Public Radio, this virtual unanimity that the lifetime ban imposed on Donald Sterling for his racist rant was just. But a Globe column today asks if we shouldn't be concerned that it was a private conversation that led to all this. We'll ask you. Then medical ethicist Art Kaplan on whether doctors should consider cost implications when giving treatment or prescribing drugs. Then Suffolk Law Professor Renee Landers on a slew of Supreme Court action, including, if you're stopped for a minor offense, can the police search your cell phone without a warrant?
A Boston woman anonymously throws herself over a homeless man being beaten by two football players. Would you have the courage to do the same? Then Garen Daly tells us about the best food scenes in all of moviedom, and we'll ask you for your faves. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Florida Panhandle appears to be getting the worst from the latest band of destructive storms that have spawned tornadoes in the Midwest and South this week. The region has received as much as 20 inches of rain in just 24 hours. Some people had to be rescued from submerged homes and cars. Governor Rick Scott warns the worst may be yet to come.
We have to be careful. We're going to get more rain. We're going to have flash flooding, and our river's going to flood. As this water flows down to the rivers, we're going to have river flooding. So we've got to be very cautious.
This week's storms have claimed at least 36 lives in multiple states. Paul Brown reports that in North Carolina, a line of storms is creating flood conditions and tornado risks.
The National Weather Service reports several tornadoes touching down in various parts of North Carolina, and the agency's posted tornado warnings across the central part of the state, including the capital area of Raleigh-Durham. Forecasters say as the storm system moves through the Carolinas and into the Mid-Atlantic region, the change in weather conditions will make the tornado danger all the more significant. In eastern North Carolina, Fayetteville officials say they have rescued more than 70 people as rain flooded homes, cars, and trucks. In the Piedmont and Mountains to the west, thunderstorms bringing heavy rain and wind have been the big event with no major damage. For NPR News, I'm Paul Brown in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
We turn now to Nigeria, where activists are warning that dozens of teen girls abducted from their school in the northeast by suspected Islamist extremists are being forced to marry the fighters. NPR's Afabia Quist-Arkton reports that a mass protest march was planned in the capital, Abuja, to force the government to do more to rescue nearly 200 teens who've been missing for more than 2 weeks.
First, it was reported that the schoolgirls had been trucked into the Sambisa Forest, a notorious rebel hideout in faraway northeastern Nigeria. Extremists have been known to use such captives for sex, but one local elder, Pogu Bitrus in Chibok, where the school is located, told the BBC the reality could be worse.
Some of them have been married off to insurgents. You know, the medieval kind of slavery, you know, you go and capture women and then sell them off.
Such information and rumors are hard to verify, but local officials say some captives may have been taken across Nigeria's borders to neighboring Cameroon and even Chad, with fears the girls are being used as sex slaves and servants. Afabia Quist-Arkton, NPR News, Dakar.
Despite the threat of bombs and other attacks, many Iraqis continue to stream to polls today to vote in parliamentary elections. Hundreds of thousands of troops and police are patrolling the streets to help protect Iraq's first national vote since U.S. combat forces withdrew in 2011. U.S. stocks are mixed, with the Dow gaining 12 points since the open. It's at 16,547. This is NPR News.
From the WGBH radio newsroom in Boston, I'm Jordan Weinstein. About 2,000 RCN internet and cable television customers in Massachusetts lost their service early this morning due to what's thought to be a cut fiber optic cable. Jeff Carlson, Vice President General Manager of RCN, tells WGBH that this outage was the result of some digging this morning on the streets of Boston.
There was a major fiber cut at 7:45 this morning, which took place on Kimball and Magazine Streets in Boston, where there was some digging going on, and a 432-count fiber was cut.
Carlson says cable TV and telephone service has been restored, and only data or internet service to about 200 customers is currently down. He says he expects service to be completely restored by 2 o'clock this afternoon. RCN serves just over 860,000 customers in Massachusetts. A Bay State funeral director who was sharply criticized after he agreed to handle funeral arrangements for Boston Marathon bombing suspect Tamerlan Tsarnaev is writing a book about his experience. Peter Stefan, the director of a Worcester funeral home, says he received thousands of angry phone calls and threats from people who called his decision un-American. Stefan took responsibility for Tsarnaev's remains after a funeral home in North Attleboro was picketed. Massachusetts lawmakers are backing a requirement that all social workers for the state's child welfare agency hold a license to practice in the field. Under a state budget amendment approved late yesterday by the House of Representatives, newly hired social workers would have 1 year to obtain a state license. All current employees would be required to be licensed by July of 2015. Support for NPR comes from America's Natural Gas. Learn how Florida Power and Light combines solar and natural gas to generate electricity 24 hours a day. Thinkaboutit.org. Rain this afternoon, temperatures in the low 40s. I'm Jordan Weinstein. This is WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH. Live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So as outraged as I think virtually everyone is over Donald Sterling's racist remarks, obviously he is the owner of the LA Clippers, how many of us have said things in private as well, only because they were in private? It's a predicament that Boston Globe columnist Jeff Jacoby raises in a really good column today. Jacoby writes that the other disconcerting thing to come out of Sterling's undoing is the realization that a right to privacy no longer seems like a right, but a thing of the past. So we want to talk to you at 877-301-8970. At what point do we need to be held accountable for what we very deliberately do, but in our personal lives? Is there really still a distinction between our personal lives and our public or professional lives, or are we living through the end of privacy as we know it? You know, he cites a lot of examples in this case. Obviously, the NSA intrusions, which are intense. The upskirting case, so you don't have privacy there. Barack Obama's infamous bitter clingers. Remember that fundraiser in San Francisco
when
he's talking about clinging to their guns and their Bibles and whatever? The 47% comment from Mitt Romney, the John Curry comment. He doesn't mention this, I don't think Jeff does, in his column that we discussed with John King the other day, yesterday, about apartheid potential in Israel. The bottom line is that, and I should be very fair to Jeff, he goes out of his way for half his column to say he is as appalled by what Sterling says as we all are. However,
but here's where my favorite part of the column. He's talking about the way most of us live our lives in our homes with our spouses or our kids or our significant others. When he says, "I have sometimes uttered words in the heat of a domestic squabble that I later regretted." I think a lot of us can relate to that. "I have expressed thoughts in personal conversation that I would never want to share with the world. On occasion, I have yielded to impulses in private that I would be loath to be judged by in public." So he's saying that a lot of us gossip horribly. We say nasty things about our relatives. We say nasty things about our colleagues or our bosses, whatever it is.
Did you ever say anything bad about me?
I never.
Okay, fine.
Once.
No, I just want to clarify. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Is that the, you know... I won't detail them all.
Fine,
I may have
you.
Said a couple of things here
Fine.
And there. But the point is, in your home with your spouse or your girlfriend or boyfriend or with your kid, you say things that you – if you said them in public, people would judge you as some kind of horrible person. Everybody's not perfect. I'm not saying that there's like Donald Sterling, but people do not say –
Do you know Mark Cuban is?
Yes.
Mark Cuban is the outspoken boss, owner of the Dallas Mavericks. Now, there's an interesting epiphany that he apparently had 2 days ago before Adam Silver, the head of the NBA that no one ever heard of. He's new and now will be famous forever. He was quoted, Mark Cuban, as saying, "This is a slippery slope." Those were his words, you know, private conversation, et cetera. Yesterday, he'd done a total 180 and said in a tweet, "I 100% support what the NBA commissioner is doing." But he raised an issue about this. And incidentally, I think Jeff did this quite masterfully, Jeff Jacoby. You are not excusing the behavior of Sterling by saying there are other issues here. He quotes, of all people, someone you generally don't think about when it comes to privacy issues, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, arguably one of the greatest basketball players ever lived, obviously in the Hall of Fame, shouldn't, and he wrote, an op-ed on Monday, and he quotes Abdul-Jabbar, "Shouldn't we be equally angered by the fact that his private, intimate conversations were taped and then leaked to the media?" And it is a real serious issue. So we want to know at 877-301-8970, not just in the Sterling case, because that just opens the door. Really, I'm not that interested in discussing the Sterling case. The issue is, are we at a point now where we have no expectation of privacy? Jeff mentions there are obviously some privileges, as they're called in law. What you say to your lawyer can't be disclosed, theoretically. What a priest and a penitent say in conversation can't be disclosed. But the reality is that privacy, I know this sounds so pathetically trite and not news to anybody, but I think raised in the context of the Sterling case, it's interesting, is essentially, you have to assume the default position is anything you say or do is going to be filmed by somebody on their cell phone, is going to be taped by somebody on their cell phone, and is, if you're famous, like Sterling is probably going to be in the newspaper the next day.
Well, that's the thing that, when you think about it, is so weird about this, because we presume he was having these conversations. And by the way, she wasn't supposed to have done this. I mean, she was taping someone without his permission, which in Massachusetts and California, you're not supposed to do. But so we'll see what the ramifications are of that. But that's what's so weird about this. You know, they were in their home for at least a good chunk of this, and supposedly she's got many more hours.
He alleged, you did just say, by the way, that he knew this was being taped. Are you aware of this? They did not violate California law. He knew that this
when
is,
she said all these things about black people?
That this conversation was being taped, yes. The guy's, he's 80 or 81. No one's really 100% sure what he is. But let's get away from the Sterling thing and say Jeff's point is that this is yet another indication of how absolutely, absolutely gone our rights to privacy are. And again, make it in your own life. Think about something you've said at work, at home, on a playground, on a basketball court, in your car, and say, can you imagine if everybody you knew, forget a big national story, can you imagine if everybody you knew and you were judged based upon what you expected to be a private conversation? It is really frightening. And again, it's not to say Sterling should not have gotten a lifetime ban. I think what Silver did was really courageous and the right thing to do, but it is a frightening prospect.
Well, what do most people spend some time doing with their significant other in life? They gossip about other people, or they complain about other people, whether it's their mother-in-law, their children, their the person that their kid decided to marry. I mean, that's a classic example of people about complaining about the person their son or daughter wants to marry.
What did you and I do? We walked out in the hall outside
gossiping.
The newsroom today.
It was vicious.
Gossiping about people we both know. I mean, that is what we do. And for a second, if you had turned to me in the middle of that conversation and said, stop right there, what you just said about John Doe or Jane Doe, how would you feel if tomorrow that was on the front page of the Herald or the Globe? I mean, you could never walk outside of your house again.
Let's have the record clear here. You were saying the things about John Doe and Jane Doe.
I was saying, fine.
Jim, that's not very kind,
yeah, exactly.
Jim. That's what I was saying.
877-301-8970. So does the Sterling case raise issues of privacy? I don't know if they rise to legal issues. We're going to have Renee Lander, as a professor at Suffolk Law School, in about an hour with us. And one of the things we'll bring up with her, in addition to Supreme Court cases, is whether or not there are legal privacy issues here. I don't think there are. But as a practical matter, it's pretty frightening. Let's go to Start in Lexington. Stan, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for the call.
How you doing? Great to hear from you guys.
Thanks.
There's something that hasn't really been brought up that I'm very curious about, which is the fact that he was flipping out about Magic Johnson. So it seems like to me he was getting mad that his girlfriend was hanging out with somebody who was HIV positive. And it doesn't seem like anybody's talked about that at all.
I think you were totally wrong. I think my understanding is he was upset because she was just in a photograph with him. I don't think he was asserting, even though he said she could do whatever she wanted with Johnson other than bring him to a game.
That's what he said. He specifically goes, you know, you can go off and, you know, do whatever with him, which I think was kind of a knock. Like, you know, if you're going to hang out with this guy.
Maybe, but how does that change anything? By the way, I have heard discussions of what her intentions were. And incidentally, for whatever it's worth, while she's been cast in the worst possible
way,
let me finish. She is saying in the last 24 hours, let me finish, Dan. She is saying she feels miserable about this whole thing. I'm just saying what she said. She is nothing more than an archivist for this guy. I have no idea what's true or not, but that's the deal. But today's conversation, Stan, is not about her and her culpability. The conversation today is about an expectation of privacy that is disintegrating in every direction you look, virtually every single day. But Stan, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
We talked about this yesterday, but it's relevant to this discussion as well, about the guy that goes in for the colonoscopy.
Right.
And by accident, well, he wanted to be able to record the post-operative instructions.
Right, that conversation's coming up next.
Yes, and he kept it on during the procedure, and his expectation of privacy was utterly and totally shattered.
Well, it is going everywhere. I mean, the most egregious example I can think of, and it's pretty hard to say that anyone's worse than the other, the upskirting thing that just happened, where the legislature in a nanosecond changed the law. I mean, think about it. You ride the subway, and you don't have an expectation that someone is allowed legally to take a photograph up your skirt. I mean, it is just, and by the way, as I'm sure you all recall, it was technically legal as of that moment and then made illegal when the legislature moved at lightning speed, which it doesn't do on much.
We have an email from Stephen saying, imagine how much trouble he would get in if some of my emails to people on the radio were published.
Exactly. Jeff, you're in Hyde Park. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the call. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi.
So I had two things. The first one is really quick. One, your comment earlier, Jim, about Mark Cuban is slightly off.
How so?
If you continue to read his comments from the other day where he talks about the slippery slope, you'll see all the way down at the bottom that he said, but whatever the commissioner decides, I will stand behind.
Oh, I didn't. Thank you for the correction or the amendment.
So,
I appreciate it.
Don't worry. You're not the only one who's made that comment. I heard it earlier on the Diane Rehm show as well.
Well, then I'll blame her. I got it from her. Even though I didn't hear her show today, I got it from her telepathically. Go ahead, Jeff.
The second one is this whole idea with the right to privacy. We have to remember that we are part of or that Donald Sterling is a part of a private organization that has certain codes of conduct. And regardless of what his personal views are, he broke those codes of conduct by in any conversation that could be recorded or could not be recorded. That it just was the right to privacy and the free speech pieces are for the government.
Oh, let me be clear, Jeff. If I wasn't clear, and you're correcting me again, and I think appropriately, I wasn't clear. I'm not talking about the law at all today here. I said we'd ask Professor Landers later about it, but I'm not talking about the law. I'm talking about just living your life with virtually no expectation on a subway, in a bedroom, at a private meeting, that what you say or do is going to stay in that on that. If that forum, that's as a practical matter, not as illegal. And you're obviously right. We're not talking about any government protection here.
Well, you think that it's
Jeff,
awfully...
thank you. I mean, the only protection would be, let me amend what I said myself. I mentioned to Marjorie before, my understanding, I think I'm right, is that he understood he was being taped. If he did not understand that he was being taped, it is illegal in a whole host of states to tape anybody without their permission. Both parties, got to be two-party approval in a bunch of states. And as Jacoby points out, two of those states are California, where that happened, and Massachusetts, where we are standing.
But you think of the scenarios. You know, you think of a couple that's going through a divorce. You can think of one side recording, not to publish it, because you do have the protections here with both sides have to understand it, but just to humiliate that other person in their workplace or among their relatives or something like that. The fights people have in those last days, I said the personal conversations people have in their family, the potential
here. You keep harkening back to that, Marjorie. I say something, and mostly in jest, I say something every day
at
one of my workplaces that if it ever got out, and I mean it totally in jest, would be mortifying.
I know, but I think this is even more private because it's not at his workplace. This is with his mistress in his house.
His archivist, to you.
Well, his archivist, yeah, but whatever she is.
Whatever
she is, in his home. And I think he just did – that's what kind of strikes at the heart of me is that it's in his home. With someone he's supposedly having a trustworthy relationship with. Anyway, Lisa from Quincy. What do you think, Lisa?
And by the way, Lisa, before you speak, she contends, for whatever it's worth, just to finish the story, whatever her name is, contends that she did not leak this to the press. I have no idea if that's true either. Hi, Lisa.
I don't know if that's true either, but all I wanted to say is he's just a bad guy who was hanging out with another bad person, and he trusted his information with the wrong people. And it's nothing new that you're going to get blowback from that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but there are other examples we've talked about. The woman who had the photograph taken up her skirt didn't trust the wrong people. Mitt Romney didn't know. Was it Jimmy Carter's grandson who taped or recorded or
released?
Yes,
the 47% remark that Mitt Romney made. Or, you know, Barack Obama talking about people getting comfort from their guns during the election in 2008, I think it was.
But so where do you, assuming, but your point, Lisa, where do you take what you're saying? Where does that, where do you end up with that?
I guess I just think that it doesn't have the broader implications that you guys are making it out to have. Or not just you guys, but everybody. It's not about all of our privacy being invaded, or I don't know. I guess I don't know my point. I just think that.
No, I think you make it. No, I think you make a good point. I know your point, but what I'm saying is it's one more brick in the wall, as the saying goes. You know, you add this, even if it's that doesn't. It doesn't have broad implications to what Jacoby speaks about, from the NSA to a politician speaking in a room to upskirting. It's just further evidence of the fact that you can't trust that what you say or do anywhere is going to stay in that place.
I guess how I feel about it, Lisa, is the technology on cell phones has enabled people to tape record you without your having any awareness that they're tape recording you. So if someone has a grudge against you or doesn't like you or is after your job or whatever, you know what I mean? They could just do this. And they're not going to publish it the next day's, you know, newspaper, but they could cause you a lot of problems. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, they could. So be careful with how you treat people and be careful not to make those grudges.
But Lisa, I mean, maybe you're Saint Lisa over there, but lots of people have complained about a boss or a colleague that are good people, but they just, you know, they're mistreated by their boss. They complain about it to a colleague. That's not making you a bad person. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean. I just think that Donald Sterling is an exceptional situation.
Well, yeah, you're probably right. It doesn't fit the all the other stuff, I mean, technically, that we're talking about. And so, again, as Jacoby and Marjorie and I are all saying, nobody feels any sympathy. Well, I don't think anybody feels any sympathy for the guy. It's just scary, I guess, is the bottom line. Lisa, thank you so much for the call. So I've admitted that I probably say something every day that I'd prefer that people not hear. Go ahead. Go ahead, it's your turn.
You didn't give me the details. Didn't say exactly what it was.
Half of what I say to you. What are you talking about?
Well, I just thought you might want to share it with the listeners, the things you have to say.
No, you're making light of this because I can tell you're nervous. This is one of these things.
Oh, if I said things I would not want everybody to know? Absolutely.
How about this morning? Have you said anything this morning to me?
Oh, it's terrible.
No, I'm serious.
Just
did
awful.
You say anything to me that
well,
you...
it was only because you goaded me.
Okay, fine. 877...
You're going to say, come on.
301. I did.
You dragged it out of me, Jim.
89.7. And you know what? I have to say, this is one of these things where it is a rare place where liberals and libertarian conservatives can become one. I mean, it's sort of like we talked about the other day that the lead on drones was not taken by a liberal Democrat, which you would have thought because they don't want to criticize the president of the United States or their own party. It was taken by Rand Paul. This privacy issue is huge. We discussed it, you and I, on our other radio station for a decade after 9/11 because the whole line was we're willing to give up a little of our privacy for the sake of our security. Well, we've moved, hopefully, beyond that enough that people have to stand up and say that Edward Snowden had a point. You may think he's a traitor, which I do not, but some people of fair minds do. But the reality is he exposed something that is really frightening, no?
Yeah, well, I think, I think, I've always said to myself, because I wasn't like on the internet when I was 10 years old, that you've got to be very careful with what you write down and send out. You just could be very careful with those kinds of things. The reason this is scary is because it was said, again, I'm repeating myself, it was said in his home to someone he thought he had a trustworthy relationship
What's
with. And that brings it to a whole different level. Oh, don't... I think the guy was named Martin Lemansky or something.
He was
a Boston City Councilor for ages. I'm going to kind
of
get it halfway wrong. But he said something like, you know, don't write when you can talk. Don't talk when you can wink. Don't wink when you can nod. Basically saying, say nothing to nobody.
And didn't Elliot Spitzer add to that? I mean, seriously, or maybe someone wrote about Elliot Spitzer. Or who would then say, and don't email when you can.
Yeah, don't. I mean, look at all the people that have been caught by their email. So you kind of expect. Tell people this to your children all the time. Don't put stuff on Facebook you don't want everybody to know. Well, look at your friends' Facebook pages and see if anybody's following that rule. There's a lot of things on Facebook.
Yeah, but the only difference is there. You have to be a dope to not understand, I don't care how old you are, mm-hmm. that if you put something on Facebook, it's an invitation for the world to see, despite whatever your privacy settings are.
There are a lot of dopes.
Well, there are a lot of dopes, but the scary part is when you haven't been a dope.
Yeah.
And the NSA is doing what they're doing, or the camera guy is doing the upskirt thing on the subway, or whatever it is. I mean,
a lot
it really
of people
is frightening.
Tweet things out that they regret too.
I mean,
they just tweet things out in the moment, and then it's there forever, and people see it, and who knows how many people see it, and they're really sorry. So tweet in haste,
you know,
repent in leisure.
Or not. Oh, that's beautiful, actually. Is that you, or is that Benjamin Franklin?
I just made that up, Jim. It just came to me.
Okay, well, let's continue, because I forgot my thoughts. Steve, you're on a cell phone. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for the call. Hi.
Hi. First, let me say that I've got a lot of respect for radio personalities like you guys, because I'd last about 10 minutes.
You mean because of what you'd say, right?
How the heck you guys do it? You know, saying I would. But anyways, my point is, I'm retired now, but I worked for a major corporation. And this was about 7 years ago. At a Christmas party, one of the guys told a sort of a off-color joke about, you know, a certain racial person. And it was all within, you know, like three or four guys just, you know, sitting around and having a couple of drinks. The next day, back at the office, he was gone. Just gone.
Why? Because someone turned him in, or someone overheard
him? Somebody turned him in. Somebody dropped a dime on him and just wasn't tolerated. It's not like the old days, 30 years ago. I recall some of the stuff that I used to say in the office, both, you know, with men and women. And now I say myself, talk to my friends. How the heck did we ever get away with that?
Well, you know, in some ways, Steve, that's a good development because I guess we're more sensitive. In some ways, it's a bad development because you can conclude you almost can't say anything, particularly if something is said in jest, because if people don't get the tone or the whatever of what you're doing, you could have a very short shelf life. Steve, thank you for the call. By the way, TMZ says that the girlfriend, whatever her name is, wanted Sterling to record her. And as a result, he knew he was being recorded, which shows he's even dumber. I mean, he's all.
I thought he knew she was the archivist. I didn't think he knew she was recording the part about Magic Johnson and the black people, but obviously I was incorrect about
that. Her name, thank you to one of our colleagues, is V. I guess
she's got a mystery first name.
Stiviano is her last name.
It's a mystery first name. And by the way, we should point out that she's involved in a lawsuit because his wife is, mm-hmm. is his wife of 50 some years is suing her because allegedly this guy gave Ms. Stiviano all sorts of fancy cars.
Bentleys and
Jaguars
and
bought her a multi-million, or I think it was $1.8 million condo, an expensive condo.
Have you
case.
Seen the photograph that has been in Borowitz, our favorite satirist, the Borowitz Report?
Yep. What did he
used
say about
the photo
this?
Yesterday, the photo where it's totally unfair, but mm-hmm. It's fine in this case. Sterling is sitting in a seat at a game in a pink polo shirt, and he's leaning back, and his hands are resting.
Oh,
his rather large
God.
Stomach. And you know our friend Dan Payne, the political
yes,
consultant,
I do.
Said when he looked at him, he concluded that Sterling was having Ms. Stiviano's baby. Is that?
Which and he was about to deliver. In fact, he was overdue. Let's go.
I mean,
to
it couldn't happen to a nicer guy, which does not at all cause Jacoby's point to be not relevant. It is a hugely important point.
Yeah, there is a certain karma here going on with
there is.
Mr. Sterling. Okay, Phil from Sagamore. What do you think, Phil?
Hey, Phil.
Great show, great topic.
Thank you.
Marjorie, I agree with you. I asked a friend, the town administrator, once in private why he refused to use email. And he said the mafia rule, never put in writing what you can say on the phone. Never say on the phone what you can say face-to-face. But I think with cell phones and recording, the technology has changed to the point where we're going to have to be really careful what we say anywhere. Again, great show, and I wish you a great rest of your show.
Oh, Phil, you're a sweet guy. Thank you for a good point, and thanks for the kind words.
Yeah.
877-301-8970. But the problem is, you know, the underlying notion here is you got to be careful about what you say. And obviously, if you're about to say something like what he said, the issue is not just privacy. The issue is you should get help, obviously, because the guy has a sickness. I think it's fairly safe to say. But again, it is, as I'm standing here, I almost feel some sort of thing in my body about how disquieting it is that you can't, there really is no privacy zone. There's no cone of whatever.
Cone of silence.
There isn't.
And we're trying to get smart. We just step into the cone of silence and it would close around you. Maxwell Smart. That's what we need, Jim.
I know.
We need to go in. When you're going to say really nasty things about somebody, hold on, we have to go into the cone of silence.
Right.
But then you'd be afraid there'd be tape recorders inside the cone of silence.
Of course there would be.
It's like in Fahrenheit 451, they had the big television sets.
And I
always think they would be spying on you. They were spying.
Don't you remember the conversation we had with Congressman Capuano?
Oh, yes.
About the We Are Watching You bill.
Television sets.
Where there is technology. He is co-sponsoring with, I think the guy's name is Walter Jones, a Republican from North Carolina. I think that's his name. This We Are Watching You bill, where this technology exists already that allows your television to be watching you. And if you're lying on the couch, and by the way, this is true. If you were sitting on the couch, and what's the expression to use?
Canoodling.
Exactly.
That's right.
All of a sudden, a Viagra ad might show up. No, I'm serious. On your TV, you're eating potato chips, and a beer commercial might show up on your TV. I mean, that's. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, or yet
and
another example
it.
Of there's no
think
privacy
about
anywhere.
When you're home at night watching television, I mean, lots of times you're in various states of undress. You
exactly.
know what I mean? You could be in your underpants, as it were, if you're a man.
No, as it were. Yes. Thank you. That. Paul, you're in Somerville. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Paul. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, you there?
Yeah,
yes.
We're here. Go.
You know what's disturbing about this issue is
what?
Whether you're Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative. This is J. Edgar Hoover. This is basically trying to blackmail people.
Yeah.
And let's face it, there's an old expression, what you do says so much I can't hear a word you say. You know how many comedians, whether it's George Carlin, Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor. Don Rickles was notorious for ethnic jokes. I judge a person by how they treat blacks, homosexuals, Jews, Muslims, etc., handicapped people. You can have the foul mouth, right, whether you're a woman or a truck driver, and have a gentle heart and soul and actually do volunteer work.
Yeah.
Tip your waitresses and waiters. Now, I don't know a lot about this guy's personal life. He's obviously showed you that even though you make money and you become powerful, that you can actually be a fool. And that's what he is. He's a rich old fool. But how many people have actually sucked up to the guy and let him get away?
I would argue, I've had this discussion with a lot of people, a man who I have tremendous respect for, it's only at arm's length because I don't know anything about him personally, is Doc Rivers knew about all these things. He's a revered coach. He went there because he was offered $7 million and he had a couple of star basketball players. And I think he's got some accounting to do too. So, Paul, thank you for the call. I mean, a lot of people were enablers here. He does. The NAACP enabled this guy.
I know.
They were about to give him, the second Lifetime Achievement Award? This is a guy who, on the record, even though he denied liability, but he paid, $2.8 million, discriminated against people of color in his housing. I mean, it is surreal what money and power can buy. Let's take one or two more quick ones.
Patrick from Attleboro, what do you think about privacy in your own home being taken away?
Hi, Patrick.
Hi. I think that there's maybe a huge difference, but there's a difference in the motivation of the person that's taking the information that's, doling it out, right? If you're looking at me and my friend and we're having an innocuous conversation and they dole that out, it's harmless. Well, they're still giving out information that I had privately with them or recorded or whatever. But if you have somebody that's using the information for, let's say she wants to be a model or is getting more followers on Twitter, or there is some type of, I guess like a profiting in a way, let's say with Snowden, there's a difference between when they released the whistleblowers, released the Pentagon Papers and masks, and then you have Snowden doling out bits and pieces, but also using it to leverage amnesty with different countries and whatnot. Instead of just saying, hey, I'm a whistleblower, here's the whole bulk of information, I'll just drop it in your lap, do with what press do what they want.
Patrick, just stop there for a second. Do you think that Edward Snowden has done... I mean, even if he has committed crimes, is the result of his behavior something that was good for this country or bad for this country?
I think that the information released, I think for the general public, kind of like the Pentagon Papers were, I think it might be I think it might have a good ball-standing effect as far as checks and balances with government.
Well, yeah, exactly. I'm with you. And by the way, when the President of the United States was asked the same question at a press conference months ago, his position was that we were already working on NSA privacy and privacy issues at the same time. And now technically that may be true. Do you think there would have been any reforms proposed by the President of the United States had Edward Snowden not disclosed the breadth of frightening intrusion into our lives that he did? I think the answer is no. So, you know, you can be both technically a criminal and someone who's done an important public service. And I think he, frankly, did. Patrick, thank you so much for the call.
Can you imagine if you were having trouble with your neighbors, you know, and they're, you know, there's a real neighbor.
I can imagine that, kind of, yeah.
And when your neighbor actually, you know, slips the cell phone close enough to your window that they can hear you talking about them. Imagine that.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Maybe you have to move.
Yes, you would.
You might have to leave the country.
You might have to leave the country.
I know, it could be really
don't
terrible.
Don't even consider it, Marjorie.
So that's a good thing to remember, okay, Jim? Keep that in mind.
I will, thank
okay.
you.
Okay, up next, we are going to be joined by medical ethicist Art Kaplan to go over the latest medical news. A great conversation with Art Kaplan on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Remember last winter? Well, here's one good thing that happened. More than 10,000 sustainers earned their very own WGBH production credit. Now, it's your turn. Sustainers break their gifts down into monthly installments that automatically renew. And if you sign on as a sustainer before the first day of summer, you might see or hear your name listed alongside some of the best producers in the country. Get your name on the list at wgbh.org/sustainer.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Lahey Health, committed to providing leading-edge care right in your community, helping you become and stay healthy all through your life. You can learn more at LaheyHealth.org. That's LaheyHealth.org. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. For anyone who's been in the hospital, do you ever get uneasy when you see a young kid, he's fresh out of medical school, poised to perform a procedure on you? Well, your anxieties may be justified. Turns out many medical graduates aren't prepared to be full-fledged MDs. And what about the seasoned doctors who we're supposed to trust? How would you feel if you found out they were making fun of you and your body while you were under the knife? Marjorie's laughing, not for long. Joining us to take on these and other medical headlines is Art Kaplan, Art's head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Lingo Medical Center. He also co-edited the new book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Hello there, Art.
Hello.
Hi,
how
Art.
Are you?
Okay, well, we're going to get to Sarah Palin and plus every patient's worst nightmare in just a couple of minutes. But before that, there's been this big debate back and forth. And letters to the editor are following this piece in the New York Times questioning whether doctors should care about the cost, and the scenario being that some treatment is really, really expensive and the doctor is going to say, well, we're going to give you the second best treatment because the first treatment is too expensive and mm-hmm. we need to care about the larger society and the state of Massachusetts budget kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So what's the deal with this? Should doctors be involved in making decisions based on cost?
So we call that challenge, what is the ethics of physician advocacy? And I'll give you two models. Margie, you can have a doctor who says, I'm going to do everything I can for you. I'm going to get every marginal benefit. I'm not paying attention to cost. But if I think something has even a long shot chance of helping you, I'm going to try and get that for you. Then there's another doctor who says, Marjorie, you know, Massachusetts is fiscally in trouble, so I'm going to have to steward resources. I'll do well for you, but I'm going to keep an eye on cost. Which one do you want?
Yeah, I guess I don't want the one that's going to be worried about the cost.
So cost is tough to bring to the bedside. I understand why people want to do it. I don't want to say it's prohibited. I think that would be too strong, because if there's a test A and a test B and they're equally good, you ought to use the cheaper one. Certainly substituting drugs sometimes when there's a main brand drug and a generic that's just as good, that makes sense. I don't think, however, we can turn to the doctor and keep trust in medicine and say, yeah, you worry about the gross national product of Brazil and give some thought to how the stock market's doing, and then you decide what I need.
Well, you know, I tend to agree with you, and obviously Marjorie does, based on the hypothetical you gave us. But are you going to lose? Is your side going to lose this debate?
Well, I don't think we're going to lose it at the bedside. And by the way, remember this, Jim, there's a lawyer hiding under every bed just waiting to jump out and say, hey,
right,
you
exactly.
rationed my patient? Oh, I'm suing you. You didn't offer them the most expensive thing or you had cost on your mind. So unless you made a radical change in how we handle malpractice and, if you will, defensive medicine, no doctor's going to really swing toward cost first. All that said, we do have to wrestle with cost. My only point is I don't think it belongs at the bedside. I think you go upstream. You might say, with this hospital, we only stock these medicines, or our pharmacy committee agreed that $100,000 for a drug is too much. We're not going to offer that here. It's not that cost decisions don't have to be made. They do, but I don't like them when they're at the bedside.
You know, obviously the central issue, and I assume the reason you don't like it at the bedside, you mentioned the word trust a couple of seconds ago, and it is very hard to trust your doctor if you think he or she has a calculator next to your bedside, as you said.
And a meter running, you know, it's like a...
No, exactly.
We're kind of thinking, oh, you know, I'm 88. I had a couple of heart attacks, a few strokes. Are they really going to go to the mat for my dad if cost is really at the top of their mind? So,
well, I wasn't going to bring that up, but since you just did very quickly, but end of life, there is a separate issue. Is there not? You say at the bedside, you don't want the doctor being the calculator of cost and having a timer on. But isn't the bedside part of where the cost consideration should be made? When it
Absolutely.
Comes to but someone who's really at the end?
What I want the doctor to do, what I would think is the good ethical stance, is to say, this is pointless, this is futile, or the benefit is trivial relative to what you're going to get. I don't really want him coming along and saying, 88, pretty disabled, nap, too costly, don't think so. So to me, it's all benefits. It's all harms done. We should kind of go in eyes open as to what really is possible for that very, very sick 88-year-old, that's fine. Have that discussion. If you lead with cost, no one will trust what's going on in end-of-life care.
You know, one last thing from me on this, Art Kaplan. You always read, though, that a huge percentage of our healthcare costs come in those last few weeks of life. So if people are having these, if physicians are having these discussions, they mustn't be listened to in a lot of cases. Or,
well, you know, Marjorie, I had a discussion recently with a doc from the UK, and he said, you know, it's interesting. By the time you guys, meaning us Americans, start talking about hospice, we've buried everybody. I mean, they're not doing the extraordinary things we do at the end of life. We're big believers in rescue, that anybody can be saved by our great technology.
Yeah.
So I think people come with a lot of guilt. They come with a lot of high hopes. You know, if you watch television and medical shows, everybody gets better. The best place to get resuscitated, have your heart start again, is on TV. I think it works about 96% of the time on TV shows.
Yeah.
In reality, 6%. That's the real chance of CPR resuscitating a heart. So I think we have to come with more honest, forthright discussion, and we've got to start to address some of those emotions and fears. You know, am I doing this because it's good for Dad, or am I doing it to show Dad that I love him? And it may not be the best way to do that to have, you know, an operation done on him.
You know, speaking of operations and speaking of trust, I just want to touch on this briefly because I'm hoping you're going to say this is an outlier and we'll just move on. There is a case out of Fairfax, Virginia, where this guy goes in to get a colonoscopy. And apparently, I'm not sure, his phone stays on, and it records the conversations of the doctors while he is getting a colonoscopy. And it's not one of those colonoscopies where he's half out, he's 100%, mm-hmm. he's chosen 100% out. One of the lines the doctor says after 5 minutes, after 5 minutes of talking to you in pre-op, she's talking to what she thinks is the under-sedation patient. I wanted to punch you in the face and man you up a little bit. Turns out a medical assistant touched, let's say, the private part of the patient during a colonoscopy, even though obviously it had absolutely nothing to do with a colonoscopy. The doctor
and
then goes
jokes
on.
Jokes about diseases involving that private part.
Exactly.
Too.
And then the a final line from one of the doctors.
Now you're going to get to the unethical part soon. Right?
they talked about firing a gun up his behind during this thing. we want to hear you say this is the outlier so we can move on, so we don't have to worry anytime we're under anesthesia that these kinds of conversations and behaviors are going on. Should
it is the outlier. I've sat through a lot of, or watched a lot of procedures, I should say, and I don't see people making those cracks and jokes. And sometimes I've been there and they don't know who I am. So it's not that they're kind of, you know, censoring themselves because the ethics guy is there. But I'm not going to say. There's a lot of dark humor around medicine, and people get bored, and they do the colonoscopy again and again and again, and they start getting goofy. I don't want to say never, because that wouldn't be right. I've heard some aspersions cast upon patients for various reasons. It isn't right to do it. It's certainly discouraged in the culture. I'm not going to say it never happens, but it's outlier. It's rare.
So what should happen to these two physicians as a result of their outing that they were making these really kind of
I think
nasty...
they should sit them down with the patient, confront them with what they said, and then say you're sorry. Explain this. I mean, in other words, the best thing we could do is sort of hold people accountable for their stupid behavior. I don't think you have to drive them out of medicine or, you know, put them in the stocks in the town square, but it would be fine to confront them and say, explain this. Wouldn't be bad to have them explain their behavior to the chief medical officer, too.
And by the way, in the meantime, for just to update people, there's $1 million lawsuit filed by the patient against the doctors and the team for their behavior, saying that he
suffered
psychological
harm. Well, that's another way to do it. Yeah, that's another way. I don't think that one will go far, but they'll probably get some kind of a settlement there that's somewhat less than $1 million. But you should be accountable and held accountable. And by the way, one of the things we try to do is get nurses or others who hear this kind of thing to report it up the chain of command, mm-hmm. because that's how you get it to knock off. So that's their ethical duty.
We're talking with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, as we do every week. Art, I wanted to ask you, there's a CDC report about the biggest measles outbreak since 1996, because while most kids are still getting vaccinated, a small percentage are not. But I wanted to ask you about something that I hear all the time at baby showers and with my friends who are young mothers. There's a real suspicion now of vaccinations. Sometimes it's linked to autism, but it's also linked to the fact that babies used to be a little bit older, 2 months, 4 months, 6 months before they're getting all these vaccinations. Now it's either, you know, that when they're being born in the hospital or like within 2 weeks of their birth. So is that related to this, even though the numbers are small, to this suspicion of the vaccination business?
Well, I think there is. We've talked about trust. We're heavy on trust today. This is a loss of trust in the authorities, in medical expertise. Too many people are getting rumors and innuendo about vaccines off the internet. For some reason, there seems to be some brain disease that's rampant among celebrities that babble on about the dangers of vaccines. Just when Jenny McCarthy has a change of heart, Alicia Silverstone or somebody else steps forward and says, no, I don't like vaccines. It's like, what is going on in that community? Interestingly, though, think of it this way. If you're a worried mom, you let the dog lick your baby. You have the baby crawl on the rug. Trust me, there's about a billion times more nasty stuff on the dog's tongue than anything that's in a vaccine. The world is, and this will freak Jim out, but the world is crawling with creepy, crawly, nasty things. The way you live in that world is to build up immunity. If you're worried about the quote-unquote dangers of a lot of vaccines, there's just no comparison between putting your kid in a daycare center and exposing them to the, shall we say, effusions of their fellow inmates in there,
right.
or having pets around the house. I mean, it's just silly. It's a dopey, silly worry. I know parents want to do the right thing. I'm not saying they're being unethical, but you got to really start to look at the reality of where infectious things are out there, and they're not in vaccines. You really need to get vaccinated. We got measles and mumps and whooping cough
right.
breaking out all over the place. It's the bet is on the vaccine.
But I guess what I'm getting at is it's changed. I mean, when my kids were little, they were older before they needed to get the vaccines. I mean, they were still infants, but it wasn't like in the hospital when they were born or the first 2 week checkup. So why?
Well, you know what? It's funny. The only reason it wasn't, the only reason is, say, flu vaccine.
Yeah.
We didn't have enough. So they used it. They used to start at 6 months and then go up to the elderly, and
right.
then healthy people didn't get it. Now healthy people get it. Now they're pushing that vaccine down to near birth. It's all supply. We didn't have enough years ago. We made more. That's literally the only reason why we used to have those age restrictions when we did. And I'll repeat it again. I think a lot of people are worried about too many vaccines all at once.
Yes.
But there just isn't enough stuff in vaccines. They're tiny amounts of things. You're going to be worse sitting on the car seat or going to the doctor in terms of what you're exposed to than getting three shots on a given day. And I'm no fan of shots. I don't like them either. But they're not loaded with stuff that's going to make you sick. What's loaded with stuff that's going to make you sick is the bus, the daycare center, the rug.
But Art, right. The part of the problem, I mean, this is a circumstance where you're not obviously equivocating at all. You're stating your position 100% firmly. But where is the counter public education campaign from your side? I mean, you mentioned the celebrities who've caused this to be a national debate around the country. It seems to me if the medical community, if the ethical community believes as strongly as you do and as uniformly as you do, someone's got to be saying it for them so that young mothers understand what the reality is. That's not happening, is it?
It isn't. And there isn't enough engagement with what you see on the internet or saying, you know, if you want to see the other side, go to this easy to use internet resource. I know there are celebrities out there, since we're beating on celebrities, who do vaccinate. I'd like to hear from them more. You know, we tend to even have a problem in the media. Vaccination becomes a two-sides thing. On one side is a person who just barely graduated college and probably could name three science words who doesn't like vaccines versus some vaccine expert. Let's debate. I mean, it's not that way. The science way tips over the public health, the safety issues toward vaccines. So if you give equal time to the critics, 50-50, you're setting up a false dichotomy.
Okay, can we move on to another terrifying situation? This is this is called the Lack of Trust Day with Art Kaplan, not in him, but in others. There was a story in the New York Times again, written by a doctor, which I found to be horrifying. I'm going to read you just the beginning. Pauline Chen is the name of the doctor. One night early in my internship, I received a frantic page for help from a fellow intern. Seasoned nurses had been unable to draw a patient's blood, which senior doctors had ordered be done if a fever spiked, so they called the covering doctor, the first-year resident. For more than an hour, he poked at the patient's arms and legs until the patient said, "I'll hit you if you come near me again." And then the intern says, "We didn't have to draw blood in medical school. My med school didn't think it was important for us to learn." And the article goes on to talk
about... By the way, I got to jump in there. And what medical school was that? The homebrew medical school of yesteryear?
You may be responding to the question. I mean, I went to law school a century ago, and it was the beginning of the era where you couldn't get out of law school unless you were involved in some program where you actually went in a courtroom and represented, for example, I represented people in misdemeanor crimes. So at least you got a sense of what it was like. I knew what a courtroom was like. So I guess based upon your interruption there, this again is an outlier, the basic skills.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's a big-time outlier, inexcusable. There's a whole set of basic skills, how to put a catheter in, that sort of thing that you just have to learn during your third and fourth year of medical school. Excuse me. And in you'd be repeating that again in your first year of residency. So that's a skill set that you just have to have. And they're, you know, it's not the old fogey stuff or something. That's core.
But that's the case in the same piece by this Dr. Chen. She says that the Association of American Medical Colleges, which I assume a legit organization, has come up with a set of general skills that med students need to have before starting a residency. Skills like conducting a physical exam, recognizing clinical emergencies. If the norm is, almost without exception, that they have those skills, then why did they bother to go out of their way to say they have to have them? You know what I mean?
I do. And I think that's just kind of an updating thing. You know, we get all excited about our scanners and our other high-tech toys that we forget to say something like, hey, let's make sure you're good at listening to heart sounds before we let you out of here. So there's a little bit of the pull of the technology, and isn't this gee whiz bang great? But there's still a core set of hands-on basic skill procedures that you absolutely have to know, absolutely have to be adept at. Coming out of medical school, think of it as a reminder. I think that's what's going on. Don't get all caught up in the gizmos. I mean, I hear a lot of people complain to me, here's a skill, conversation. They say they go to the doctor's lost in a computer, and they can't get him to turn around and talk to them. So it's a version of that.
That's so true.
That's so true. But Art Kaplan, what about the old adage that you really should avoid having a major operation in July or on a Sunday, because in July all the new doctors are just arriving at their first hospital on Sunday. Everybody, the good doctors are all home for the day off.
Don't ask me that. I have to confess, I think there's mild truth in that.
This is terrifying.
I knew it.
It's better. In other words, just so the listeners understand, the new people come on in July, and they're not as savvy, and the nurses are watching them because they know they're new and they're just figuring their way around. It's better to be there like maybe a month or two later after everybody's figured out what's going on.
Okay,
so
keep that
elective
in mind.
Procedures in July.
Don't do it.
Well, that's really a great little note there. Hey, Art, before you go, we thought we'd play a little sound from someone I know you work very closely with through the years. Here she is speaking. We'd like your comment quickly. Here she is speaking at the National Rifle Association meeting.
Waterboarding is how we baptize terrorists.
We almost never play a soundbite twice, but I think that merits a second play. Can we play?
Oh, God.
This is Sarah Palin, obviously, the former governor, former vice presidential candidate, former governor of Alaska. Here is Governor Palin yet again at the NRA.
Waterboarding is how we baptize terrorists.
Okay, you have a reaction to that, Art Kaplan?
Well, one of our greatest philosophers. So, yeah, I do. I think waterboarding is what cowards and people who are amoral do. They have a position of power over somebody, and they torture them. It is the haven of scoundrels. And my view of that is despicable. Plus, I happen to know it's an insult to Christian baptism. I mean, that's the place where you get forgiveness. It's not the place to use the waterboarding metaphor. Other than that, pretty good.
But wait, before you go away on this thing, does the medical community, and I'm embarrassed that I don't know, whenever the whole torture debate rears its head with John McCain or Barack Obama or Alan Dershowitz or whomever, does the medical community get involved in those debates, or is this
they do?
As, they do.
They do, because we have ethical restrictions, World Medical Association and AMA, against participation in torture. Doctors, and by the way, psychologists and other healthcare personnel are not supposed to do it. So when it happened, even in places like Abu Ghraib, there is certainly an issue about did they break their moral code. And there's a few bills around in different state legislatures, particularly prohibiting participation in torture by doctors. None of them have passed, but those bills are rattling around, I know, in a couple states now.
No, I had a lot more I was going to ask you, but I had some surgery planned for July that I've got to go reschedule quickly. So, unfortunately, we have to
go. Remember this. If you don't go to a medical school-affiliated place, the same rules don't hold. And that's where the new people show up.
Oh, okay. Thank you,
Good
Art.
Good to talk to you, Art.
My pleasure.
Oh, as always, great to talk to Art Kaplan, who is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also co-edited the book, Contemporary Debates in Bioethics. Art joins us every week. Up next, when it comes to being confronted with danger, are you a fight or flight kind of person? How an Alston woman risked her own safety to protect a homeless man. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
For America's teenagers, it's testing season. State exams, college entrance exams.
The amount of tests you'll take is probably up around 70 or 60 tests.
Might even be more.
Kids aren't the only ones complaining.
The problem is that's a lot of testing.
But how much is too much? And does the U.S. go too far? Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Lesley University, where creativity empowers educators, artists, and counselors to turn their passions into their futures. Lesley University, what will you make happen? More information available at lesley.edu. And Gentle Giant Moving Company, serving New England since 1980, now offering moving and storage services coast to coast with offices in major cities across the country. More info at gentlegiant.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. You know, there's this famous thought experiment that's been kicked around the philosophy departments and universities for decades. I'm sure you've heard it, but if you haven't, it goes like this. Is a runaway trolley barreling down the railway tracks? Ahead on the tracks, there are five people tied up, unable to move. Trolley's headed straight for them. So you're standing off in the distance. You have a lever next to you. If you pull the lever, the trolley switches to a different set of tracks. Unfortunately, you notice there's one person on the side track, so you have two options, Marjorie. One, you do nothing, and the trolley kills the five people on the main track. Or two, you pull the lever, diverting the trolley onto the side track, where it will kill one person, which is the correct choice. So that's what goes on in ivory towers. And then there is, and it's mentioned in a great little Globe editorial today, heroic bystanders stepping into the void. It talks about how down on the ground, an Alston woman was faced with a similar situation. It's 2 a.m., she's alone walking down the street when she sees two big men, it turns out they're former college football players, standing over the third. They are slamming this guy's head into the pavement. What does she do? Does she run away? No, she runs towards them, throws herself on top of the unconscious man until the police came. And by the way, we tell you her name, except she didn't want anyone to know
Anonymous.
Or give her credit for it.
I
so
love it.
We want to know, is this something you would do?
Oh, all the time.
Do you have these kinds of instincts? Are you a fight or flight kind of person? And we'd like to know what you would do at 877-301-8970. And equally importantly, we've discussed this with you in other contexts in the past. What separates people like that woman? This is a woman putting herself on top of this guy. Turns out he was homeless, unconscious. Well, there are two guys, both of whom, it turns out, they were arraigned a couple of days ago. This happened in January. They're over 6 feet tall, both weigh over 200 pounds. She runs towards the guy who's getting his head slammed into the pavement and shields his body with hers. Would you do it? And obviously, unless you've done it in the past, you don't really know, but do you think you'd do it? And two, what is the difference between her and us? The most famous story, at least in my lifetime of this, is the story we've mentioned many a time, is the, I think he was a Vietnam veteran, if I remember, but he was a veteran of some sort.
He was a Vietnam veteran.
There's a guy who's fallen onto the tracks in New York City on the subway tracks. The guy jumps onto the subway tracks.
Hold on. He's holding the hands of his two daughters.
Oh, you're right. He pushes them back. You're right.
And they're fairly young.
Yeah. He either moves them back or asks somebody to take care of them or something. Jumps down onto the tracks himself. Lays his body on top of the body of the person who had fallen onto or jumped on the tracks. I'm not sure. The train runs over the two of them, missing him by, a half an inch or some incredible thing?
Yeah, he knew the train was coming. And the only way he could save him was by putting himself over this guy who was having some sort of seizure or something so his head might pop up. Oh, yeah, I that one for sure. That's an easy one.
But by the way, this is...
I would not be doing that.
So let's ask you, in this context, if you had seen this guy being beaten unconscious by two fairly large men. As I say, it turns out they both played football. One at Marist College, one apparently at BC. They both went to Xaverian Brothers.
I know, good Catholic together. Education.
There you go. They deny having done it, by
they
the way.
They do deny
their lawyers
it, of course.
Deny that they did it. But wait, so what would you do? Here's what I think, what I'd like to think I would do. I'm embarrassed to say I don't think I would have thrown my body on top of the other. I like to think I would have yelled at the guys. I clearly would have called 911. I hope I wouldn't have just kept on going. The frightening part of this, which I read in Wicked Local this morning, and I hope I got this right.
Oh, it was 2 a.m. Did you say it was 2 a.m.?
Yes, 2 a.m. I know I got this right. Is Dan Conley, the Suffolk County DA, called, according to Wicked Local, 17 witnesses before a grand jury. Now, what that means by definition is that 16 of them did not throw their bodies on top. Now, I'd like to think they did something. Maybe they called the cops. Maybe they yelled. Maybe they did something. But apparently, at least if one reads into the story, what I read into the story, there's 17 people lying or standing around at 2 a.m., and this woman decided to throw her body on top of this homeless guy's body, a guy she didn't know. He apparently was unconscious at this point, in the face of two 6-foot-tall, 200-pound men. It is surreal.
I think that a woman is at a certain advantage here, because if
you
were to approach them, you are a very tall guy. You used to be really big. You've kind of shrunken lately, Jim. Congratulations. You've lost a lot of
Thank
weight.
You, I appreciate
but anyway, if they saw you coming in your old self, lumbering down the aisle, they would kick
the crap out of me.
No, they would say, this is a big guy. He's going to kick the crap out of us.
And I would think not.
Well, maybe when you got closer to them, they'd realize that probably wasn't going to happen.
No, that's what I meant.
But from a distance at 2 o'clock in the morning, they'd think, this is a really big guy, and they would attack you because you're a big guy. I think women have a certain advantage in these situations because usually, although, I mean, you never know if someone's a real creep, but you kind of don't envision men kicking and smashing.
So are you trying to minimize what this woman did?
No, I'm not minimizing it. I'm just saying I think in some of these situations, women have a certain advantage.
Well, let me give you a situation where there's no advantage.
Hold on.
Yeah.
I also think that what's really incredible about this is this was a 50-year-old man that was being attacked, a homeless man.
But she didn't know
that, though. I think lots of people would do it for a kid. I think you'd do it for a kid. Because
we didn't even know how much she knew. It's 2 a.m. How does she know what the state of the guy was? All she knew is
they
were beating on this guy.
There's not a five-year-old child out at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Let me pick a more current example that we were talked about quite recently, which has nothing to do with whether someone would go after a woman. Remember a woman who was sitting in the chair to my right during a quiz against her father about a week ago?
Yes.
Natalie Stavis.
Yes.
What did Natalie Stavis do when she was running the 2013 marathon after the bombs went off?
She ran toward the danger. She ran toward the bombs. She's
Cops
a physician.
Tried to stop her. She said, I'm a kid's doctor. I'm going to go. She runs. Did she know if there were more bombs?
No, she did not.
Did any of the dozens, if not scores, of people who had no idea if there was a third bomb or a fourth or a fifth, did they know?
No, they didn't.
And I'm not talking about first responders, who, by the way, were brilliant. I mean, there's no question. I'm talking about real people who aren't first responders.
Well,
she sort of, but she was there to run a race. She wasn't there to do healing.
No, well, that's right. She was not someone that was paid to be into the fray.
Or had volunteered to do it.
The gentleman, the Vietnam vet that jumped into the New York City subway. But I wanted to point out that one of the things he said afterwards was that he didn't even think about it when he was interviewed.
Yeah,
it was almost
you're
like
right.
an instinctual
that.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
So he didn't weigh the pros and cons of, I'm leaving my children here alone on the platform. I could be orphaning my two kids. You know, if I get killed, who's going to, you know, what's going to happen to my children standing here on the platform? You can use your kids for excuses in a lot of situations. I've done it many times, heaven knows. But I think that was sort of interesting. He just did it without thinking. It was almost like a reflex.
So it's possible that you and I have more heroism in us than we think.
Or less.
I haven't been confronted. I mean, I've seen some situations. I haven't been confronted in a situation like this woman was, where I'd have to literally physically intervene to save a guy. And by the way, if you read the stories, the likelihood is the guy would have been dead if she had not.
Yeah, he was in critical condition.
He was in critical, and he remembers nothing
banging
of this once he
his
recovered
head against
the sidewalk.
And what is wrong with
couple
these
of sweet guys? Let's
sweet
go to
guys.
James on Cape Cod. You are next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Thank you for the call, James.
Well, thank you for taking the call, and I'll tell you, it's a long time ago now. I'm an old man now, but back in the early '80s, you know, when I was at SMU. I came across, I was walking through the thing at the dorms there, you know, everyone is. And the brother of a current state senator, I didn't know this at the time, the guy wasn't a state senator at the time, he was an undergrad, was getting jumped by a couple of guys. And, you know, it offended my sense of fairness. And I just jumped right in and drove them off. And
good for you.
You know, most people that, you know, would do that, when you get two or three guys and someone else, they're all cowards. You know, you take a poke at them and they're going to go.
Well, except if they're drunk, for example. And there's no, if someone is drunk and has no idea what's, I'm not allowing them to escape a responsibility here, but you don't know. Sometimes you think you're tougher and you're stronger and you can take anybody on. But James, did you say when you were talking a minute, did you think about this for a second or was it total reflex?
No, it's total reflex. And actually, you know, it's one of those things where you want to hit someone, but common sense restrains you until you find the case where you can think you can get away with it. So even if I hit this guy and hurt him, who's going to say anything to me? It's my chance to friggin' tag someone else. You know, it's like,
well, James, you fall into that category of an ordinary person doing extraordinary things. Good for you, and thanks for the call.
Maybe the issue here for you, Jim, is you maybe needed more experience tagging people in the past.
Well, whatever it is. I mean, you know, maybe I would do what he just said or what this woman just said. You obviously want to think you'd do that kind of thing, because I think it's fair to say without sounding out. I mean, you care about other people, and I care about other people.
I do.
But putting yourself,
I think we all do,
in the middle of a violent situation, it's really tough. And it really is true. I mean, the marathon thing is almost overdone now because we talked about it nonstop. But it is historic. I mean, it wasn't one outlier. It was dozens and dozens and dozens, from the Carlos Arredondos to the Natalie Stavises to just all these bystanders. It is unbelievable.
I also think with men, it has more to do with how confident they are in their physical abilities to fight, which is different than girls, too, or women.
Well, I mean, the analogy, I know, since you're going to mention it in a few minutes, is when I was younger, I don't do this anymore, when I was involved in like a driving dispute with someone, I would always try to check to see if it was a small, older woman who was driving the other car as opposed to a brawny. You were going to say it, so why not? You have to calculate your chances.
But I'm glad you confessed. How? She was over 75 and under 5 feet tall.
Right, and shrinking, right.
Okay.
Let's take another call.
Let's go to Kevin in Brookline. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Kevin.
Hey, folks, and love your show.
Thank you.
I work for a nonprofit group called Urban Improv, and we teach bystanding classes with kids in regards to where we get kids role-playing through different issues, life issues, and sort of then discussing why they made the choices they made. You know, we'll bring the kids into the scenes, and then they get to play them out. And we usually start off with a bystanding issue where we show them many different situations, some involving danger, some involving authority issues, and so on and so forth. And when the kids talk about it, it's one thing. But when they get into the scene, they always behave in ways that surprise even them.
How so? What do you mean by that?
Well, they get involved where they thought they would never have gotten involved. Mm-hmm. Like talking to them, especially in the world that we live in now, they talk about like filming stuff in YouTube and phones come out if they see a fight, and they talk about how everybody now sort of, rather than get involved, they want to film it. Yet when they get into the scene, it's like all of a sudden they see something bad happening, and they find themselves intervening, and then they talk about how they were surprised that that was their reaction. So I think a lot of it has to do with the spur of the moment. Like, so we don't know what we would do until faced with that situation.
How valuable, though, I mean, an Urban Improv, I know it was a fabulous operation, but Kevin, how do you know that in a role-playing thing that what someone does when in the back of their head they know it's role-playing, not real, how do you calculate whether or not someone's behavior in that context would likely correlate to their behavior in a real-world context of the exact same situation? You know what I mean?
I do, and it's a very legitimate question. Is we found, after years of doing it, especially with kids, although it's a model that tends to work across the board, but especially with kids, nobody plays make-believe like a kid. They believe it. They're in there, especially with the older kids where you're doing, like, you know, situations with some meat to it. They get so caught up in the drama. I'm actually leaving work as we speak, and today was a teen pregnancy day, and you sort of had the kids in there, and to watch their eyes and to be working with them, they were having that conversation. And so they forget. They forget that it's a scene. You know, they still have imaginations. They're still in there.
Got it.
And they give themselves over.
Kevin, that was a great call. Thanks. That's great work,
too.
I love that kind of stuff. So do I.
I love that kind of stuff. You also hear these stories. It's a little bit different, but about, you know, mothers, you know, they'll be like their kid will get run over and the mother will go over and pick up
lift
the car.
Lift the car. Well, those are real. You know, they say, is it adrenaline that does that? I mean, there's some physiological thing that happens.
I remember when my first child was born that a spider was crawling up the leg of a stroller. And you know what I did, Jim? I went over and I grabbed that spider right between my thumb and index finger and I just squished
it. I'll tell
you. I thought that was unbelievable. Heroic.
You're an incredible woman, Marjorie.
I am.
You really are.
You don't call me supermom for nothing here.
877-301-8970. The reason we're talking about this is a Globe editorial today talking about this incident on January 26th where a woman, 2 a.m., and the hardest...
I wonder if she was an EMT or something.
Well, they don't say in Brighton, and two big guys are beating up, and it turns out a homeless guy. They're, in addition to beating him up, they're
punching,
slamming his
kicking.
Head into the sidewalk.
It's disgusting.
She not only does not run away, she runs over, puts her body on top of this guy she doesn't know to shield him from these two guys. And this, it goes on to say that Michael Hudson, that was the homeless guy who's being beaten up, suffered a brain hemorrhage, the Globe says, in the assault, rushed to the hospital, remained for 3 days, no memory of what happened. But it ends with, but without the bravery of the young anonymous passerby, Hudson might not be alive at all. Now, see, that's the difference between you and me. If it turned, let's assume we did have the courage to do what this woman did, and we like to think we both did. You are the kind of person, I know you pretty well, you're the kind of person that would say, I don't want to get any publicity for this. I did it. I'm glad I did it.
What would you do, Jim?
I would put out a press release. I would call one of our coworkers, who's a really good writer, and say, can you slam something out?
And you'd be in the front page of the Herald and the Globe.
Well, I don't know if I do that. But I mean, that's another part of this. I mean, doesn't that say something about the person, by the way? The kind of person who doesn't want any credit for this.
Maybe working for the CIA.
No, I'm serious. It really, they're going to heaven or wherever they want to go, I
think. Let's go to Hal in East Boston. What do you think, Hal?
Hey, Hal.
Hi there. Well, I've been in a situation or two that tells me that in sudden emergencies like this, the brain does a quick calculation, and it tells you one of two things. It tells you either you can jump into this and without any danger to yourself, or it tells you if you jump into this, you're going to get yourself killed. And I think the brain calculates that very quickly, and it tells you that you can do it or you'd better not do it. Just the other day, some guy was helping a woman who had gotten robbed, and he chased the robber down the street, and the robber turned around and stabbed him and killed him.
Ah!
So he intervened, and he shouldn't have.
Hal, you make me think of the situations you hear about in war, where soldiers will go out to go after a fallen comrade, knowing full well they could get shot or have a grenade thrown at them or have whatever. So they're making the calculation incredibly that they're probably going to die, but they do it anyway.
Well, Hal, before you respond to that, the two examples we've talked most about today, the Natalie Stavises of the world and this woman on January 26th, isn't there a reasonable expectation there might be another bomb, or in this case, reasonable expectation the two brawny guys are going to beat the you-know-what out of you? So, I mean, they chose to go into those situations regardless, Hal.
Yeah, if you're a man, you probably wouldn't want to throw yourself on top of this guy, but you'd want to do something.
Yeah, I hope so.
I think a woman could get away with it. I don't think even two football players are going to start pounding on a woman.
I think, Hal, I think you and Marjorie are both crazy.
Wait a second.
The kind of person who slams the head of a homeless person into the sidewalk is going to not punch a woman?
I think, Jim, that a lot of women think that. Maybe we're right or maybe we're wrong, but I'm with Hal. I think that in these situations, I think a woman can almost be more daring because I think it is less likely that they're going to slam a woman's head.
Well, Hal, thanks for the call. We don't know who these two – well, we do know. I mean, in the arraignment, they named these two guys. Again, they're pleading not guilty. One was a football player at Marist College. One was a played at BC and had subsequently been suspended from the team. They both played, I guess, and were together at Zavarian Brothers when they were in high school. You think they, based on what we know about them and their size and their behavior – vis-a-vis this, what's his name, Michael Hudson?
Yeah, I think
they'd say, well, wait a second. It's one thing to slam the head of an unconscious homeless person on the sidewalk.
Positive.
It's another thing to shove around a woman. They'd make that distinction.
I think there's not 100% of the time, but I think in many cases it's one thing to be beating up a man, even a homeless man who's down on the ground. It's another thing to be beating up a woman. I do think that, especially like a middle-aged woman.
But just so I'm clear, and Hal's gone, but I want to make clear again, you're not saying that as a result, it's understandable that a woman would show more courage because she is making a calculation. It's less likely.
The reality is that this woman decided to do an act of heroism
because she cared about another person.
It's a little easier to intervene in these situations when you are a woman because the chances are less that a man is going to punch you in the face.
Except let me tell you the difference, Marjorie. I think counteracts what you and Hal are saying is, I don't know what the average woman's size and the average size of a man, if those two guys decide to take on a man, the likelihood of them doing damage to him is a great damage to him is less than damage to a woman who's probably going to be 30 pounds lighter, 4 inches shorter. So she's taking a pretty calculated risk.
There's not the macho, mano a mano kind of deal going on. I mean, listen,
maybe you're right, but I don't know.
Okay, let's go to Lisa in Melrose. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
My son was actually there that night.
No.
You're kidding.
No, and my brawny 24-year-old was one of the big guys that were with this tiny little woman, and they were all standing back. I'm not proud, but I'm not going to identify her, obviously, but she is exactly as she's being presented. She's a tiny, tiny little Southeast Asian woman. She weighs probably 85 pounds. She's the bravest person I've ever met. She's traveled through Europe alone, and she's a remarkable young woman. And this is, you know, it didn't surprise me to hear that she did something like this.
Lisa, what was your son was, they were just hanging out? Is that what happened?
Yeah, they were coming, well, the reason I didn't know this is because he was supposed to be home, but they were coming back from a party to, or drinking, or you said it was a party, but obviously they were drinking, and they were from a bar in Austin, and they were going back to one of their friends' apartments and came upon the scene in Austin. And, you know, there were other people around because there were people at the house. There was a, you know, there was a party on one of the streets, so there were people around, but it was literally it was more of a Dee Genovese moment for other people, but certainly not for this young woman.
First of all, Kitty Genovese, who we haven't mentioned, you just mentioned, just I'm sure most people know, was in the 50s in Queens.
Yeah.
She's getting killed, and tons of people are watching, and nobody does anything. That's the sort of the ultimate example. But a couple things. One, without putting you in a spot as the mother, what'd your son do?
Nothing.
Okay. Well, you're not
and
honest.
What did he say? What did he say about
it? Well,
doing
he didn't even tell me about this for weeks because he was in trouble because he had my car. But he shouldn't say that. He was dialing 911.
Okay.
And not close to the victim.
And you know this woman, and obviously, and he does.
Yeah,
what is her? Why has she decided that she wants to remain anonymous? What is that? Why? What's
she's
the?
Just like that. Well, she actually is getting a master's in nursing.
Uh huh.
And so she does have. And you were saying you think it might be somebody who has, you know, some sort of, you know, medic background. But so I mean, she definitely is. You know, she's trained. She's not an ENT. But she's that's the kind of person she is. She's, you know, traveled alone through Europe, and you know, my son has met her up in different places. She's just an incredibly brave, tiny little girl. I mean,
Lisa, just one last thing, because we're up against the clock here. So the scene was that these guys are beating up this homeless guy. There's many people.
They
were at a party. Okay,
right. And there were other people from the party who were. This is my son's version of it. So, you know. And so there were other people who came downstairs who saw what was going on, who were at the party, that did nothing. My son, his, and some friends, and this young woman, she was ahead of them. She was walking ahead of my son and his friends, came upon the scene first, saw what was happening, and threw herself on.
It's unbelievable.
Wow.
Hey, Lisa, could you do us a favor? Could you stay on hold for a second and give your number? I want to talk to you off the air. Give your number to one of our producers. Lisa, we're really glad you called. That fills in a lot of blanks. How great is that? I mean, does that not make the story even better than it was before?
It's a great story, and she's a good mom to concede. Her brawny son is there. And
well, at least he called 911.
At least so he called 911. That's right. He did do something. Okay, when we come back, Suffolk Law Professor Renee Landers joins us for a Supreme Court roundup, from the EPA and air pollution to police accessing our cell phones without warrants. What hangs in the balance at the Supreme Court is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Marco Werman. This letter landed its writer a job in Hollywood.
Dear sir, I like words. I like fat, buttery words such as ooze.
It's part of a new collection of unusually well-written letters from history.
I like spurious, black-as-white words such as mortician.
Letters to employers, to lovers, to a rocket scientist. A British blogger uncovers letters of note next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Brigham and Women's Hospital, home to research on how aspirin can prevent heart attacks and other diseases. More available in a video at brighamandwomens.org/aspirin. Brigham and Women's, life, giving, breakthroughs. And Fox Hill Village of Westwood, providing retirement living and cooperative ownership to active seniors for over 20 years, including White Oak Cottages, its new concept in memory care. FoxhillVillage.com and WhiteOakCottages.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3 to review the latest from the Supreme Court of the United States is Renee Landers. Renee is professor of law at Suffolk University Law School. Hello there, Renee.
Hello.
How are you?
Thank you. I'm well, thanks.
Great.
Thanks for having me here.
Pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. There is this very upsetting Supreme Court case involving cell phones and looking at cell phone records. So fill people in on this one.
Right. Well, there are actually two cases, Marjorie. One started in California. It involves you know, a person who was stopped in a traffic stop and he, you know, for a minor traffic violation. And, you know, the police searched his cell phone and were able to therefore link him to other more serious crimes. And the California appellate courts upheld the search of this information on the cell phone and the information granted the, you know, that the law enforcement obtained by doing that. And then there's a case that originated here in Massachusetts, the Worry case, where again it started out as a, you know, fairly routine traffic stop. And there, in that case, it involved a flip phone. So it wasn't as, you know, dramatic, the level of information the police could obtain. But the First Circuit, the United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit, said that the police could not search the cell phone without a warrant. And so throughout the, you know, evidence, in theory, that was obtained through the search of the cell phone.
And you know, the Globe, I think, puts the question quite well in their front page story. Can police have access without getting a warrant to a suspect's text messages, emails, photos, and other data on cell phones in the same way they can access a driver's car trunk following arrest for a traffic offense? They go on to say, I can't remember which justice broaches, may have been Roberts of all people, I'm not sure, that it's sort of like going into your house and, you know, you arrest someone for jaywalking and then you go into their house, go through their drawers, which is what a cell phone is these days with this technology.
Or at least their file cabinets, yes.
And the, I think it was
Scalia that I don't
was
really
it Scalia?
Agree with.
My apologies.
Well, he wasn't talking about, he said that it's like not wearing a seatbelt, being arrested for not wearing a seatbelt, and suddenly they're able to search the person's entire iPhone, which is not far from what seems to have happened in this case, where a person was pulled over for a traffic violation.
Right. So the... you know, this is one of those areas where the justices do not always align according to our preconceived notions of their political orientation, because I do think that some of the justices that we think of as being more politically conservative, like Scalia and Alito, maybe not Alito, but Scalia, Roberts, do have this appreciation for privacy and, you know, and preventing unwarranted government, unwarranted not used in the technical sense, government intrusions into privacy. So their decisions sometimes in this area might surprise you. On the other hand, you know, sometimes they do show some deference to the police, you know, and to the, you know, needs of law enforcement. But in neither of these cases, it seems to me, do we have these exigent circumstances where we're just sort of in hot pursuit of a really serious crime that can involve major physical or economic injury. And so why the police couldn't take, you know, the half day or something to stop and get the warrant doesn't, it seems very puzzling.
Let's stay on that. One of the lawyers, the public defender who argued the case for Massachusetts, says exactly that. There is an alternative that gives police what they potentially need, but also protects the rights. It's so obvious to me, is you seize the phone, you secure the phone, and then you go to a judge and say, can I have a warrant to look through the phone? And hopefully the judge will say, well, since you stopped the person for jaywalking, what is in his phone or her phone is not relevant to the underlying crime. But even if they do, at least there was judicial review.
That's right.
So well, is it unreasonable to think...
Excuse me. The idea of being pulled over for speeding or for not having a seatbelt on and having them confiscate your phone even to go get a warrant is just...
Well, so in both of these cases, though, my understanding of the facts is that the phone was confiscated after they have the traffic stop. They search the car incident to the stop, which is permissible on reasonable suspicion. And then they find other evidence that leads them to conclude that this person might be engaged in other more serious illegal activity. And that might give them the reason, you know, the justification to actually obtain a warrant.
Great.
To search
so
the cell phone. That's
if they
right.
get it, they get that, it.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's. But, you know, I think that... you know, but then, you know, the arguments seem to reveal also there's the question of, you know, well, can we make them go get a warrant? And then what is the warrant going to say? You know, what can you search in the phone? Just because you have a warrant to search the phone, does that mean you really should be able to search everything about the phone that might be unrelated to any of the illegal
Yeah, but you know, my response to that, Renee Landers, would be, I'll worry about that when the time
comes.
I want to make sure that a police officer, as well-intended as he or she may be, doesn't have the authority, for example, in a car stop, to go beyond a trunk. They can look in the trunk as part of stopping someone. I understand that. But your life is not in your trunk. I mean, the central piece of this case is your whole life is on your cell phone today. I mean, and it's true. Every intimate detail from photos to emails to confidential, everything is in your phone. And so it's sort of like opening up your whole life because you were stopped for a minor offense. And by the way, even if it's a more major offense, it seems to me that unless it's related to the crime that you have allegedly committed, they shouldn't be able to search a cell phone without a warrant anyway. Is that an unreasonable position?
No, I mean, I don't think so. I tend to agree with you. And I just think that the court is always concerned if it's going to put unreasonable burdens on law enforcement and trying to enforce the law. And I think that the questions indicated that they're trying to find something short of saying that always they have to get a warrant. But it may not. But I tend to agree with you that in this kind of non-exigent set of circumstances, I don't understand why the police cannot be required to get a warrant.
So, and the decision is expected by June. So when
we
report the decision to you, you can decide whether you will ever jaywalk again.
Right.
And I would suggest, my favorite cases from the Supreme Court, even if I'm not that interested in the subject matter, Renee Landers, there are cases like the one we're going to bring up now. A 6-2 vote where liberal Ginsburg joins with Justice Roberts, a conservative, Kennedy, who's often a swing vote, on one side. And on the other side is Antonin Scalia, the conservative intellect on the court, and Elena Kagan, obviously a really smart woman, former head of Harvard Law School, on the losing side. This is this EPA decision from recently.
Right.
Now, what's the gist of this thing?
Well, Kagan actually was in the majority.
Oh, she was?
One.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
So it's just Scalia and Thomas who were the dissenters.
Oh, my apologies.
No, that's quite all right. And I always, whenever you ask me a question like that, I always think that maybe I read it wrong.
But Ginsburg wrote the majority decision.
Right. Okay. And so, this is a question. This is a situation where we have Justice Ginsburg, Justice Breyer, and Justice Kagan. All are former professors of administrative law.
Oh, is that so? That's pretty good.
And this is a case. This EPA case is definitely going to be one of the legendary cases in administrative law. And it comes after a lot of backing and forthing about how to enforce the Clean Air Act and how to protect the states in the Northeast, in the East, from the pollution that is blown by the wind eastward.
But originates in another state.
But originates in some of the Midwestern and Western states that rely on a lot of coal-fired utility power plants. I mean, as Justice Ginsburg quotes the Bible, in her opinion, the wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh and whither it goeth, from the King James Version of the Bible. And so, this is a real problem in the environmental laws because pollution doesn't stay put. It doesn't respect the political, geographic boundary, jurisdictional boundaries that we've created on the map of the United States. And this is the EPA's second attempt to try to address this problem. The first one was thrown out by the courts, but the method that they chose was allowed to stay in effect until they came up with this new rule called the Cross-State Air Pollution Rule or the Transport Rule. And what the EPA did was to say that the upwind states, the states in the West, had to who were, contributed more than, 1% to air pollution problems in the eastern states, had to abate that contribution. And further, that the extent to which they had to abate it would be proportioned not necessarily by the amount of the pollution to which the upwind state contributed, but by how easy and cost-effective it would be for the state to eliminate the risk. So a state that was producing, let's just say for the sake of argument, if you could tell that a state was producing less of the pollution than another state but had more modern plants or something that were more easily able to be modified to reduce the amount of pollution that was coming out of them, might have to do more even though it was contributing to the problem less.
But explain the politics just for a second to me. I'm not surprised at all that Ginsburg writes a majority decision. But people like Roberts, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way.
Right.
I mean it historically, generally sides with businesses.
Right.
On the other side of this case were manufacturers who are the polluters in these cases who were arguing the EPA doesn't have this jurisdiction. What would cause a Roberts, Kennedy less so, what would cause a Roberts to side with a liberal like Ginsburg against manufacturing interests in a case like this?
Well, it's manufacturing and the utilities. I would say that the utilities.
Right. Another thing that one would assume that Roberts would be with.
Right. Well, but some of those utilities and manufacturing companies are also in the eastern United States. And the more pollution that comes from the west to the eastern part of the United States, the more the eastern states and the the polluters there have to do to try to reduce the air quality that they also did not cause. And so I think this is one of those areas where, you know, business isn't in a unified position.
Yeah.
It is for the purposes of this litigation, and the states are not in a unified position either, because the states have different interests. Obviously, Massachusetts would like to not have so much, you know, dirty air coming east.
You know, one of the things Marjorie broached this morning, we were talking about this case, which we have discussed in the past, I don't know if you've ever discussed with you, Justice Ginsburg, who wrote the majority opinion, who is, I think it's fair to say, is the core liberal on the court. She's in her 80s. She's had cancer, at least two times?
Right.
There are 2.5 years left in Barack Obama's term. I think it's at least a reasonable bet to say, based on his poll numbers, that a Republican has a pretty good shot of winning.
Mm-hmm.
People obviously like to have justices who serve for life having their worldview. Does it happen that a Justice Ginsburg, I mean generically, has a conversation with the President of the United States or people like this saying, my expectation is I'm going to retire a year and a half before, announce my retirement a year and a half before the end of your term, so you have time to try to get a moderate to liberal-leaning justice onto the Supreme Court through the Senate? Does that happen?
Or
I
think it can happen. I mean, I think Justice O'Connor sort of did that. I mean, she had some... Sandra Day O'Connor. She had some, personal reasons for their husband being ill, wanting to do so. But I think she did that kind of thing. I think it does happen.
Is it expected in this case?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I think, the Constitution says they can serve for life. And, and I think it's... part of it is whether, it could be a prudent thing to do and certainly would keep the keep the current balance of the court assured. But on the other hand, I think she's still very good at the job. She seems to have a lot of energy. I think it's, she really enjoys it. I'm not sure that she would be willing to make that personal decision. I don't know her that
well. She's in her early 80s.
I think so.
Right? Yeah. I bet she leaves to give him time.
She is a very pragmatic person.
I think she might do that because I think it would be difficult, as much as she loves it, to see a lot of what she's done in her years in the court.
To be undone.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's also, one last thing. I mean, the O'Connor example is not perfect because O'Connor was more of a centrist. I mean, while she would probably lean more often than not with the more conservatives on the bench, she was often the Kennedy of her time, the fifth vote that decided 5-4 cases and close cases. Ginsburg is a dyed-in-the-wool.
That's right.
Left-leaning liberal justice.
Yeah, which is why I think she's going to leave.
Maybe so.
Yeah, I think so. Well, let's talk about the Supreme Court upholding this affirmative action law having to do with Michigan and putting people in public positions and universities using affirmative action with admissions and all that kind of stuff. Tell us about that one.
All right, so this is the Schuett case where in 2003 the Supreme Court upheld the University of Michigan Law School's use of affirmative action programs for admitting students, of affirmative action for admitting students, so that there could be a limited use of race to, ensure some diversity in the educational class, in the law school class for educational purposes. After that, the voters of Michigan adopted this constitutional amendment that prohibits the use of race in any kind of public program in the state of Michigan. And so this provision was challenged on the basis that it actually erected higher barriers for racial and minority, ethnic minority groups and women, because the gender also was included in this, in order to, get special or, consideration of their circumstances under the law. The Sixth Circuit the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court has now, upheld that, saying that, even though affirmative action is permitted, at least as a theoretical proposition on the basis of the Supreme Court's precedents in very limited circumstances, there's no requirement, right, that states have to use it in order to achieve any kind of diversity.
But can you explain that? So I hope I got this right this time. The strange bedfellows on this one is striking down, saying that the voters have the power to do this was Justice Breyer, correct?
That's right.
A liberal from my hometown of Cambridge.
Right.
And it seems to me, I didn't read the decision, I read all the reports on the decision, that his argument was, the people spoke, the people went to the ballot. So is what's implicit in what he's saying is, even if he thinks that it potentially is racially intolerant, the decision, or at least will not provide equal opportunity for people of different races, people of color, that since the public spoke, that's more important than the Supreme Court's own decision of just a few years ago? I mean, that seems to be what he's saying, isn't
it? Yeah, almost. And I think that, I have trouble with that conclusion that he reached, because that would seem, you know, the people had spoken about a lot of racially discriminatory laws and practices in the past. And I think that that argument actually takes this one a little bit too far.
Well, he's no dope. I mean, what's that about?
Well,
I mean, particularly in light of the fact that his own Supreme Court had ruled practically to the contrary,
right,
which, as you said, was the basis. So it isn't like he had to go fishing for this. So
Well, so I think that it speaks to the level of discomfort that people have about using race in public decision making, because I think that I personally think that it's possible to draw lines about permissible versus impermissible uses of race, I think it is definitely getting, the slippery slope is kind of an overused analogy, but getting on that slippery slope of where does it cross the line to, to being an improper use of race and therefore interfering with other people's rights.
You know, you mentioned the concern about using race in decision making. Someone who has no concern about that, of course, is Donald Sterling, as we know. Before you go, just last thing, Renee Landers, does this guy have a legal leg to stand on? It seems to me there are two things.
Right.
One, there's a whole privacy issue. We talked about at the top of the show off a column that Jeff Jacoby wrote. I don't know if it rises to legal level, because theoretically he consented to this taping. But if the Commissioner League goes ahead and attempts to get three quarters, the owners, to essentially take his team away from, or force him to sell his team, even though he'll get the profits from that thing, does he have a credible defense, or is it purely based upon the language of the NBA Constitution?
I think it's probably perfectly based on, his rights under the NBA.
I mean, there's no larger kind of issue for him.
No, and I think that, if there were sort of some public entity ordering him to do it, then he might have some argument that was a taking, or something like that. But I think that the courts have been reluctant to interfere with some of these, sort of private
agreements.
Agreements.
Which he's part of,
which
obviously.
He's part of, and which he agreed to the terms and conditions of when he bought the team. So I think that it would be unlikely that a court would overturn that. But it's, I wouldn't put it past him to try to make the argument.
Now, since you've never asked me for any advice about your course, I'm going to give it to you anyway.
Okay,
Here's what you should do. You should have a student do research based on what we discussed the other day. How many minutes of airtime in this country were given to the Supreme Court decision on affirmative action, which could potentially affect tens of millions of people, as compared to how many minutes of airtime were spent on Donald Sterling, which arguably affects virtually nobody?
Right.
And then,
don't you think it's because the Donald Sterling thing is so easy? I mean, it allows everybody to be very holier than thou. Oh, I would never say those things. Oh, I would never do that. And affirmative action is a much thornier discussion. I mean, there's a lot of
that is the answer.
Yeah,
it is. I think it is the answer. And I think that but I think the thing that's important about the Sterling case and the case of Bundy in Nevada is that in the Schuett case, the affirmative action case, John Roberts has this tendency to sort of say, colorblindness is the value of our culture and our society, and therefore we as the Supreme Court are going to enforce that norm, and therefore any use of race, however benign or used to try to remedy past discrimination, is not permissible. And I think these examples illustrate to the public that view of the world accurate view of the world. And I think that's why it's important to talk about those two things.
So I take it back. Don't teach it in your course. We got Renee Landers. It's great to see you as always. Right. Thanks so much.
Good to see you too. Thank you.
Renee Landers is a professor of law at Suffolk University Law School. Always great to talk to you, Renee. Up next, food on film. From dogmatic documentaries that say we're being supersized against our will to the lush movies about cooking, eating, enjoying everything from French baguettes to a shared strand of spaghetti. We'll have that up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Mm-hmm.
For many U.S. college students, a major event on campus is fear of sexual assault.
This is criminal behavior. And the fact that our colleges and universities are not protecting their students is equally as egregious.
1 in 5 women college students, 6% of men, 70% of gays, all victims. Disturbing statistics not found in any college rankings. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Bentley. The Mafra Trom Bead Project for at-risk children in Ghana is anything but typical. It's part of a social enterprise designed and implemented by a group of students from Bentley University. Bentley, the business university. And Moo.com, where you can print business cards with the option of a different design on every card in a pack. You can say hello with Moo.com. That's Moo.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Food on film. It's a, well, I guess, love-hate relationship. There are great movies like Big Night, My Dinner with Andre, one of my favorite movies of all time, that celebrate food, the shared experience of eating, of conversing. Then we have those downer documentaries that show us how we're all being manipulated by Big Ag, hooked on horrible things like high fructose corn syrup. Here with us to talk about two films that exemplify these polar opposites is our friend, film critic Garen Daly. Hey there, Garen.
Hi, guys.
How are you?
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine.
So we're going to start with our favorite food scenes. Is that correct?
No, we're going to start with the two films. Let's hear. For people who may not know about the film.
I was ready to do my first scene. I was all psyched up. Okay, let's start with the two films.
Well, they're both coming out on 5/9, May 9th. One is a documentary called Fed Up. It's directed by a woman named Stephanie Sautag, I think how you pronounce her name. She did a film called Tap. But what's really interesting is that it is produced by Katie Couric and Laurie David, who also did Inconvenient Truth. And it actually came from the fact that Katie Couric had been watching or been reporting for 35 years all this dire news of what's going on with the youth of America because of their diets and all these other pieces of food-related bad health stuff going on. And she wanted to know why. So she dove into it with these people and came up with this documentary, which follows five kids who start off just exploring their world. And they're overweight. And as you explore their world, you find out that they're active. They're really good kids. They're trying to do the best they can. And they don't know what's really wrong with them. So they take that as a jumping off point to go in exploring into the world of the food industry and why it's so dysfunctional and why it's being supported by the government and why we are, as a nation, are in danger.
And okay. As you say, it does highlight the unholy alliance between government and the producers
right.
of this crap that is killing our
kids.
Which
is why Michelle Obama's gotten criticized for not dealing with some of these big conglomerates that have close relationships with the government and campaigns and all that kind of stuff. But I want to ask you something. Now, Laurie David, is that the wife of the Mr. Curb Your Enthusiasm?
Yes.
Remember that great story about Laurie David?
Yeah, I was going to tell, but go right ahead. This is one of my favorites.
Well, I guess she's a big environmentalist.
Yeah, Inconvenient Truth.
And always run around limiting Larry and how much, you know, turning on the lights and how much they were using the air conditioners and all this kind of stuff. And I remember when he got divorced, he announced he ran home to his house and turned on all the air conditioners and turned on all the lights and used as much electricity as he possibly could in celebration of their split. Anyway,
so that's the downer.
That's the downer.
But important.
Do they find out why these kids can't lose weight? I hope so.
Well, they do and they don't. It really is the fact that, I mean, there's some interesting stats. Like, there are 600,000 items sold in American supermarkets. 80% of them have sugar in it.
Yeah.
And sugar is a huge thing. It's almost a psychoactive drug. So it's our diet is screwy, and we're being sent messages that it's good, and it's all kind of very dysfunctional. But the good side of all of this, of these two films, is Chef, which is a delightful, charming, amiable film about a guy who blows it on social media and texts a critic and loses his job. But in the process, he finds himself, he finds his son, and it's all very happy, and it all centers around food.
And this is John, how do you say his last name?
John Favreau, yeah.
And this is the Iron Man guy, right, who made $16 trillion. Didn't he produce or something? In addition, does he have anything to do with Iron Man, or am I wrong about this?
No, you're very right. He is one of those go-to directors who does these big, huge films, Iron Man being one of them. But he started off making this very small film called Swingers with Vince Vaughn, and it became a cult hit. And this is kind of a go back to that little period of time. where he's making a smaller film. He calls in all these chips, great cast, Dustin Hoffman,
Scarlett Johansson.
I mean, if you're an actor or you're a director, wouldn't you want to have Scarlett Johansson your girlfriend in a movie?
Yes.
I wouldn't mind having Dustin Hoffman in my movie either, but isn't there Dustin Hoffman?
Hoffman is in it, and Bobby Cavanaugh.
Whatever his name is.
Yeah, and John Leguizamo. And, you know, it's a great cast. And it's again, it's a very nice little comedy, and it's very genial. What I like about it when I look at it is how smart Favreau is. When you take a look and deconstruct how he put this film together, first of all, it's about film, food. People love film, food and film. But it's also it's Latin-centric. You know, he's married to Sophie Vergara. They're divorced. His son is Hispanic. John Leguizamo is in it. So he's appealing to one of the great demographics in Hollywood right now, which is the Latino market, which is going to go and see this film, as is the foodies, as is the Favreau's, as is all of the great stars. So very, very smart on Favreau's part.
Okay, so Chef and Fed Up is there, which is what caused Marjorie to say, Jim, let's pick our favorite food scenes from movies. And actually, if you want to call in, we're going to be a little short on time, but our number is 877-301-8970. Pick our favorite food scene. She picked one, I picked one. We originally intended to play the sound, but because our RCN connection was down all day, we don't have the sound.
That's so terrible.
Chelsea, our lead producer, asked you, Garen, which you apparently agreed to, which I cannot believe. Once we name, we told you in advance what our favorite scenes are.
I have the
you
script.
Will reenact those scenes for us.
I will read this script because there's no way that I can reenact
some of them. You'll reenact them. So you want to go first, Marjorie?
Well, this is going to be fun, Garen. Of course, the Harry, met Sally scene when Rob Reiner's mother is there watching Meg Ryan with Billy Crystal at the diner. And Meg Ryan is proving to Billy Crystal that she can fake an orgasm.
Okay, take it away, Garen.
Well, I'm going to start taking it a little earlier than that because I don't want to get into the orgasm part just yet. I got to build up for it.
Okay.
So, Harry, I think they have an okay time. Sally, how do you know? Harry, what do you mean, how do I know? I know. Sally, because they? Well, yes, because they. And how do you know that they really? What are you saying, that they fake orgasm? It's possible. Get out of here. Why? Most women at one time or another have faked it. Well, they haven't faked it with me. How do you know? Because I know. Oh, right. That's right. I forgot. You're a man. What is that supposed to mean? Nothing. It's just that all men are sure it never happened to them and that most women at one time or another have done it. So you do the math. You don't think that I could tell the difference? No. Get out of here. Now we're going to go into the orgasm scene. And Marjorie, you're going to help me there, right?
Oh, Jim's going to help us.
No. I mean, what she does, everybody has seen this scene. It's one of the great scenes ever where she fakes an orgasm in the restaurant.
That's right. Go ahead.
Now, you might say, what does that have to do with
food?
Breathe
heavily.
Well, Garen's going to explain to us what comes up after this incredible reenactment by Meg Ryan. Go ahead.
Well, then, you know, of course, Harry says, are you okay? She finishes up, and then this older woman customer, Rob Reiner's mother, says, I'll have what she's having.
It's great.
It's one of the
it's
great.
It's great. It's great.
And by the way, not only is it Rob Reiner's mother, but my understanding from having read about this was an ad-lib thing. It was not in the original script. Is that true? Do you know?
I've heard the same thing.
I mean, how great is that?
That's a good mom.
Okay.
Yeah, very
so,
good mom.
In any case, and obviously.
Okay, what's yours, Jim?
Just one of the greatest scenes ever in movies. Jack Nicholson is one of my favorite people ever. This is almost a BC scene. I don't mean Boston College. I mean before Christ. This is so old. What is it, 70 or 75? Or
something like that.
Something.
Yeah.
Five Easy Pieces. He's in a diner.
He's in a diner.
And he's trying to order. Well, we'll hear. What was he trying to order and how did he get there?
All right. So this is Jack Nicholson as Dupuis. I'd like a plain omelet, no potatoes, tomatoes, instead a cup of coffee and wheat toast. Waitress, no substitutions. What do you mean? You don't have any tomatoes? Only what's on the menu. You can have a number two, a plain omelet. It comes with cottage fries and rolls. Yeah, I know what it comes with, but it's not what I want. Well, I'll come back when you make up your mind. Wait a minute. I have made up my mind. I'd like a plain omelet. No potatoes on the plate, a cup of coffee, and a side order of wheat toast. I'm sorry, we don't have any side orders of toast. I'll give you an English muffin or a coffee roll. What do you mean you don't make side orders of toast? You make sandwiches, don't you? Would you like to talk to the manager? Then there's an interchange between two other people, and she goes, "You got bread and a toaster of some kind. I don't make the rules. Okay, I'll make it easy for you as I can. I'd like an omelet, plain, and a chicken salad sandwich on wheat toast. No mayonnaise, no butter, no lettuce, and a cup of coffee. A number two, chick salad sand, hold the butter, the lettuce, and the mayonnaise, and a cup of coffee. Anything else? Yeah. Now all you have to do is hold the chicken, bring me the toast, give me a check for the chicken salad sandwich, and you haven't broken any rules. You want me to hold the chicken, huh? I want you to hold it between your knees."
And there it is. And by the way, you actually did it almost as well as Jack Nicholson.
Oh, I don't think so.
That was a great scene.
So food, I mean, we're going to take a couple of calls in a second. There have been some of the great food scenes ever in movies. We picked our two favorites. What's yours?
The one that I always go back to is the Tom Jones scene.
Yeah, Marjorie mentioned this morning. Describe that, because I saw the movie, but I don't remember.
Well, this is very young Albert Finney, and he is in a tavern, again, it's the 17th century, and it's an interchange between him and this voluptuous older woman, and they are eating everything under the sun, and it's like, it's salacious, it's erotic, and they are just, you know, teasing each other by like sucking on, you know, an oyster and then, you know, corn of the cob. I mean, it's just very, very sexy. And
the food is all dripping down the side of their faces. Like they bite into something. It's either chicken or it's fruit. I can't remember what it was, but everything just sort of comes down the side of their faces in a very erotic fashion.
It's my default when it comes to, you know, erotic
scenes.
It's a very funny scene.
And would you not believe, I mentioned my dinner with Andre, and Andre was one of my favorites of all, with Wallace Shawn, and I can't remember who the other actor was. But Andre Gregory, thank you. That's right. Thank you very much, Chelsea. I am the last person alive who would like a movie where two people are sitting at a table and talk for whatever it is, 90 minutes. That's essentially all that happens, is they're having a meal. One of the great movies of all time, no?
Right. It is. It's smart and it's conversational. But, you know, there is a problem. You know, if you are eating in a film, think about it. You're shooting the film. It's going to be shot several times. The plate's going to change. The person's going to get fed up with eating the same thing. So it's very difficult to film a good food scene.
Yeah. How about the scene in 9 1/2 weeks when he's feeding her out of the refrigerator? That's before it got really dark. That was a good part.
There are some great ones. I mean, think about Babette's Feast. That's another
one. Babette's Feast.
Chocolat, Water for Chocolate.
That's right.
There are so many great. And there's this thing that we as an audience love seeing the food in the screen, even though we're not getting any of the aroma or the taste.
Well, tell Jim about Big Night, because he didn't know about Big Night. That's a great movie for
John
people
Turturro
love food.
And, that's not John Turturro. It's it's a story about a small Italian restaurant that is about ready to go under. So they decide they're going to blow their entire wad on one big night, and they create this incredible feast.
That sounds great.
You know, it's sort of like Chef, where you get salvation through the food. And I saw an interview with Jon Favreau about this. He equates the concept of cooking as being the same as making a film. That you are starting, you're being creative, it's very individualistic, you know, you create something that's beginning, a middle, and an end, you're reliant on people to accept it and respond to it, and that critics can make a difference.
We're very short on time, but we're going to take a couple of calls. You have 20 seconds each, and our apologies. Dan from Worcester, you're first with Garen Daly. Go.
Hi, yeah, I'm Ozzie and Jim. I like the cafeteria scene with John Belushi feeding himself there.
And Animal House.
That's a great one.
Well, that actually is a great choice. Dan, thank you for the call.
And let's go to Dale from Sudbury. Hi, Dale.
Hello, Dale.
Hi. My favorite food scene is the food fight scene from that Tony Curtis movie, The Race Around the World. I can't remember the name of it.
Oh, it's a wild, 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 wild world? Is
no, I think
one?
The Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines.
That's it. That's
that one.
I didn't see it. Is that great, too?
Oh, yeah. It's a classic slapstick with the pies flowing and wonderful.
Okay, hey, Dale, thank you.
Lisa in Boston. What's your favorite, Lisa?
Diner, the film Diner. There's this hysterical scene where the four guys are in the diner all the time. And Paul Reiser plays this hysterically funny moocher, and he's always saying to one of them, "You can eat that? You can eat the rest of that?"
That's right.
Steve Guttenberg gets really frustrated. He says, "You want half the sandwich? Just ask. And he never can quite come out now.
Hey, Lisa, that's great. And we are going to go to one more quick one because it's one of my favorite movies. Julia from Arlington, what movie are you talking about?
the pie-eating scene from Stand By Me.
Oh, man. And what the only problem is what happens after the pie-eating scenes in Stand By Me. Julia, thank you for the call. Who directed...
That's Rob Reiner.
It is Rob. That's what I thought. Yeah, another. Rob Reiner. I mean, he really has an incredible... Princess Bride is him,
Princess
too.
Bride. But, you know, guess what? He hasn't done anything all that good lately.
What was that about?
I think that he just may have lost his spark.
Hey, Garen Daly, this was really fun. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Garen Daly is a film critic, obviously, and the writer and producer of the forthcoming film, The Orson Welles Complex. Thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Alex Beam and political writer Matt Taibbi here in studio. Can't wait for him. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, and John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
And you're eating something over there, Jim. That's disgraceful.
It's an apple. I'm trying to get healthy.
Okay. Thanks for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow.